You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Kirsten Imani Kasai is the author of Ice Song. Thank you for joining me, Kirsten.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
Kirsten, one of the things that I think is pretty remarkable about this book is the way you plunge us into this fully formed world filled with all sorts of really interesting details. When you started writing this book, did you just create it from word one, or did you like outline it and have some kind of world-building plan as you went along?
No, I didn't really have a specific plan. I don't usually work from an outline. I have general ideas. The story really kind of tells itself to me, and it's very much like watching a movie. I do supplement some of the details and do some research to make sure that something would actually work in the real world, or enough so that I could manipulate it into a fantasy world and make it work and still be believable. But it really is like walking through a door into another world, and I'm just recording what I see.
One of the things I think that's really remarkable about this novel is the actual feel of it, because it really hangs in the balance, and for me as a reader, as reading sometimes like a fantasy and sometimes like a science fiction novel, and I'm wondering if you could talk about your experience of that as a writer and as a reader between the two.
Well, it's kind of funny that this book got picked up and put into the sci-fi fantasy genre, because when I wrote it, it was just a story. I mean, I certainly didn't set out to, I'm going to write a fantasy story or I'm going to write science fiction. It just kind of came out that way. So I feel a bit as though I'm working backwards, having to figure out what all of this means and what the genre categories mean to the book, because it's certainly very lyrical and it doesn't really have a place anywhere. And for me as a reader, I mean, I like that. I like things that are strange and unclassifiable and weird and sort of entities unto themselves.
Mm-hmm. This also, too, you know, when you talk about it like that, it also has a bit of the feel of almost a fairy tale, in a sense, a fairy tale with technology, though.
It's actually structured on a fairy tale. One of the things that I read so much of when I was little was all the Grimm's tales. Mm-hmm. Folk tales and fairy tales from around the world. I love American folk tales. And so the whole structure, the idea of the journey and the mission and all the helpers and, you know, the people that come along during that journey to either push the hero on to the next phase or create a difficulty for them. I mean, fairy tales are sort of straightforward. I mean, you know, there's going to be a moral of the story, and there's A to B, and there's a goal, and there will be obstacles. So it is set up sort of in that format.
Well, as you imagined this world, I find that, you know, the way you deal with the technology to be really interesting. And I think what's interesting about it to me is that it reflects, I think, most people's experience of technology in the here and now, in that we use it all the time, but it's somewhat mysterious.
It is mysterious, and we don't really think about it. And I often think that, you know, if somebody came here from another time, even 100 or 200 years ago, or a medieval farmer was suddenly plunked down in my world, how amazing and magical everything would seem. I mean, we talk to each other over these little boxes, and we can hear each other, and we see each other, and you know, all these things are floating through the air that are invisible. So it really is getting sort of a tangible hold on a magical world.
And
I don't think that most people really understand how their technology works anyway. I mean, for me, it's, you know, a very rudimentary sense of how a phone works or how a computer works, but they do, and I trust that they will. I use them.
Yeah. One of the things I think that this speaks to is this idea that, you know, science fiction and fantasy, no matter when they're set, they're really always about the now. And this suggests to me that you have a really interesting experience of the now.
In not really being connected to it, or?
Well, just in that your sensibility as expressed in the novel is really complicated, and there is this kind of sense of magic and wonder, and also of responsibility. I really like the way your characters are created in this realm. So tell us a little bit about Sarayka Minui. It's a really, she's a fascinating character, and I think unlike any I've experienced recently in genre fiction or otherwise.
Well, I think one of the most important things about Sarayka is that she really has a strong dual nature, and I think a lot of us struggle with that. And part of her challenge is to overcome her natural resistance to who she is. You know, and I think that it's that sort of play against the light and the dark side of self and the shadow self. And for her, you know, there's some back and forth about, does she want to just give up the quest to save the babies? I mean, it's difficult. It's overwhelming. You know, she doesn't know if she's up to it. It's contradictory to everything that she is and every part of her, and yet she has to go forward. So it's really an enormous challenge for her. And I think through her, I'm trying to sort of create, you know, this mythical feeling of being on the quest, and that each of us has this obligation through our lives to sort of overcome the darker sides of ourselves and overcome our animal baseness and our reluctance to achieve the next highest plane of spirituality or thought or intellect.
Could you talk about, she has definitely a dual nature, and I think this is a really interesting turn of events, and the way you handle this is a little bit like Memento without the sticky notes.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about this kind of dual nature? Because I think that we haven't seen a lot of any fiction that talks about sexuality in the way that this novel does, in a manner that's both frank and yet really imaginative.
Well, Sarayka is a traitor, which means that she has the genetic ability to completely switch gender. So basically, her skeleton will stay the same, but all her muscle tissue and organs and all the soft tissue of her body is affected by hormones and converts into the other gender when she's stressed or upset. You know, and that's really what happens in the womb, that we kind of start from this neutral space. And then it's only through the influx of a lot of hormones that our bodies are pushed in one way or the other to develop. And so when she trades, she actually has this other condition. So not only is she have this weird ability to switch gender, but she's also sort of handicapped by this disease called the Perilous Curse, which is a disease of forgetting. And she cannot remember. There's no connection between the different aspects of self. There's no connection between the sides of her brain or any of her lives. So, you know, she's very caught up in self-control, trying to will herself to remain female or to remain male because, you know, it's really like surrendering to somebody else, to becoming someone else. And so that's really a huge, you know, if you can imagine how that would be. And to possess, you know, someone else's sexuality while you're still yourself. You know, how your behavior and your thoughts and your desires would change if you're still yourself. I mean, have had your experiences and your upbringing and your social conditioning, but now suddenly you're a man or a woman.
It's a really fascinating conception. And one of the things, too, now, throughout this novel, we encounter all sorts of, you know, beast men and monsters, which I'm kind of a monster hand, so I really like that stuff. But the novel really has the feel in many ways of a fairy tale, I think, that mm-hmm. you know, that there's this kind of archetypal journey. It seems more informed to me by fairy tales than it does by, say, you know, science fiction.
Right. I agree absolutely, but we don't really have a modern genre for fairy tales. I mean, fairy tale is sort of a lost art, you know, it's archaic to us now. And but it's really the root of storytelling. When you look at all the traditional cultures and all the stories they tell, they're fairy tales, you know, and folk tales, and they're all so similar in so many ways and so simplistic in their meanings and their goals, but God, they're so powerful. I mean, they just endure and endure and endure. And I just read something the other day that said the story of Little Red Riding Hood, which is actually one of my favorites, is like thousands of years old, and it's just been passed and manipulated through cultures and reformed and carried forward because it speaks to people. I mean, it has a really profound meaning on some deep level for us that we keep telling ourselves these stories over and over. And so I think when you access that fairy tale voice, you get something very primal, you know, the primal nature of storytelling.
Now, when you've got a world this complex, and characters who are equally complex within the world, could you talk about the challenges of, you know, turning this into a good ripping yarn, which it is?
Well, I think for me, it's not to get too bogged down in their individual details. Like, I can get, you know, very caught up in backstory. I'm one of those people that's at the airport imagining, like, every aspect of the life of the person sitting across from me. So it's hard to kind of keep myself on task and say, okay, this is all we need to know about this person, this character. You know, they each have to be really, they have to be distinct from each other and with their own motivations and feelings. And, you know, they're like real people to me. So I kind of just have to look at them and talk to them and you know, explore them in my mind. Well, who are you and why are you here and why do you feel this way to understand them? But some of it does come down to note-taking, like, okay, like with Dunya, the dog-faced girl had a very distinct way of speaking. You know, she drops her H's. And so that kind of thing, just for consistency, oh, I have to go back and check and make sure that she's not using any H's or just small things like that. So it's very, it's an expansive process, really.
One of the things that I think makes this book so wonderful is the really lovely prose style that you have. It's very rich and full. And I'm wondering how much of this rolls off the tip of your pen and how much of it is the result of grinding rewrites time and time again, reading aloud to somebody who's maybe becoming less than thrilled with hearing it for the 500th time.
Well, I've been writing for a long time, and many, many people have told me that it is too ornate. So really, for me, it's a matter of reining it in. Mm-hmm. You know, the original draft was far longer, with a lot of extra detail and description. And, you know, it's also beautiful and meaningful to me. But for a reader, yeah, it could, I suppose, feel at some point like you're wading through a thick swamp. But, yeah, that's pretty much how I write. And I'm trying to work, again, working backwards and make things a little bit simpler because otherwise it would just be like, trying to hack your way through a forest, you know.
Now, one of the things that's interesting in this book, too, is your concept of, you know, just what it is to be human,
mm-hmm.
which you play with a lot. Could you talk about that? In our world, we're all fairly human, or at least we seem that way, but not necessarily in yours. And I'm wondering if you look at people and wonder if behind that nice face is the dog-faced girl.
Well, right. I think humanity is a very flexible idea. It's really an idea more than a reality in some ways. I mean, you know, I'm just so fascinated by the similarities that we have between ourselves and other creatures and the differences and really trying to figure out, you know, why are we so different and why do we feel so privileged by who we are, you know, when we really have so many of the same struggles as other creatures that we share the planet with. You know, and it's hard when you try to define humanity, it's because we have ethics and morals, or it's because we have religion, or we have abstract thinking, or a system of money, or opposable thumbs, or whatever. But you can take those things away, and we would still probably consider ourselves human. So it's like a very gray area for me. It's very negligible, and I'm not quite clear on why we think we're so special, you know.
Well, one reason we think we're so special is because some of us can write books like this.
Yes, we can write. But, you know, there's that old maxim of all the monkeys at the typewriter, it would churn out something as well. So
I think we call that Twitter.
Yeah.
Could you talk about, will you be writing more stories set in this world?
Oh, yes, I have three more. The second one is called Tattoo, and that actually picks up right after Ice Song ends. And that's already with the publisher. It's scheduled to come out in 2011, but I'm not sure exactly when. And that's another adventure with Sorica. That one involves a lot of the same characters. We see the octopus woman again, Rava, and the Queen of the Forest. And so we're revisiting some of the same places, but there's a lot more modern elements in that one. And then there's another book after that, which still continues. This is such a big saga, and it keeps expanding, and I couldn't fit it. You know, I keep having to add books to fit the whole story in. But there's a third one, which is called Asta Requited, which is about the children. And the fourth one is really the wrap it all up, reunification, and sort of reaping the seeds that were planted in the first book. So I've got my work cut out for me.
You know, you mentioned the children, and that's one thing that we don't find in, you know, speculative fiction, imaginative fiction, whatever, wherever you want to bin this. So the relationships between parents and children are not necessarily often covered, and I think you do a really interesting job about that. Could you talk about that? Is that something, do you have kids?
I mean, I do. I have two children, and they're such a huge part of your life. I mean, anybody with children knows you can't escape from them, either, you know, physically or mentally, emotionally. You're always thinking about them. You're always wondering and longing and regretting and wishing. And, you know, your lives are so intertwined. And I think especially for women, because we go through the whole process of, you know, pregnancy and birth and caring for an infant, and it's such an intense, intimate relationship. And I think, I'm not sure if people are afraid of it or they think it's sort of sacrosanct and we shouldn't examine it too closely.
Terrified.
Yeah, but I mean,
I'm terrified.
It's like sex, you know, it's elemental. We deal with it every day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you have to be a whole person. You can't just say, well, I'm only going to address this portion of it. It's like on TV shows when they have children and then you never see the children.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually film someone's house with kids, the kids are always right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any mom knows you cannot go to the bathroom without them following you and the dog following you and banging on the door. What are you doing in there? You know, so you have to really, I don't see how you could exclude that relationship from anything.
Mm. Interesting.
And still present a complete picture of a person.
And this world you've created is so fascinating. Could you talk a little bit about maybe some of the reading that you did, you know, as a kid or as a teenager or as an adult that inspired you to, like, have this kind of imagination? It's very, very fascinating.
Well, I'm kind of a kitchen sink reader. I just sort of read whatever comes along. I've really gotten hooked on biographies and autobiographies. I love historical fiction. I love historical nonfiction. I'm particularly drawn to specific time periods. Anything Victorian has got me by the balls. I just love that time period. But when I was little, I read, I guess, a lot of, like, dark fantasy. And I read, like, tons and tons of Charlie Brown comics and Donald Duck comics. And I read a lot of adult books, you know, when I was 12. I was reading, you know, like Marilyn French and Erica Jong and adult books. So I've gone the gamut from reading children's material to a lot of the feminist writers from, you know, the 60s and 70s. And now I sort of just read for fun whatever catches my eye. But definitely some of my favorite writers. One of them was Zilpha Keatley Snyder, who wrote a lot of sort of magical, dark stuff. And my favorite author now is Angela Carter, and her writing is gorgeous, but it's very obtuse. And, you know, she's kind of my heroine and my model.
I've been speaking with Kirsten Imani Kasai. Her new novel is Ice Song. Thank you for joining me, Kirsten.
Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.